to recover from that. I think Olivia's reading that this evening, is that right? Yeah. Maybe we'll rethink that one. We do need a moment, don't we? That is shocking. If this section of the Bible was turned into a movie, you'd find it in the horror section, wouldn't you? Nothing good happens in these three chapters of the Bible. Nothing. Every single character in this story is wicked, with the exception of God, of course, but he only makes a cameo. Now, this story, it should be frightening to us on a number of levels. The first is that what we just read there, that's not a bunch of Islamic extremists. Right? This is the people of God acting here. This is the Old Testament equivalent of the church. But the second is that these people, they actually think they're doing the right thing. These people actually think they're serving God with their actions here. Now, this should make us shudder because there's nothing in this passage to suggest that Christians are immune from going down the same path. Sociologists tell us that people are blind to their own culture. So are we. We could be, you and I, today, actually doing things that we think is pleasing to God, but in the end isn't, because we're blind, just like these people were. Now, what I want us to do this morning is, when we're looking at this passage, don't sit there with judgmental glasses on. I want us to read this passage as though we're looking in a mirror. All right? When we read this passage, we need to do a couple of things. Firstly, we need to ask ourselves, how on earth did God's people come to this? This is the people of God acting here. How? How would they come to this? But secondly, we need to ask, are we any better? Are we guilty of doing things like this? Not rape and murder, but doing things that God does not like. And as we're doing it, our goal is to determine how can we protect against us going down this path? How can we ensure that we don't head down this path ourselves? We want to be Christians who are actually pleasing God with our actions, as opposed to horrifying him. That's what we're going to do. So let's dive straight in. Chapter 19, that's page 401. Begins with. So we're going to be covering out all the way through these three chapters. Having your Bibles there is going to be helpful. Chapter 19, verse 1. In those days, Israel had no king. Now a Levite who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Now concubines, they were kind of like live-in girlfriends. They were afforded a lower status than a wife. It wasn't a full-blown wife here. Most commentators think the concubines were basically like sex slaves. More like sex slaves than, you know, your loving marriage partner. And so, you know, straight away we have here, just like last week, you remember last week, we have here another Levite who is doing what is right in his own eyes. There was a Levite last week doing what was right. This week we've got a Levite taking a concubine. Why would he do that? But this woman is not portrayed in completely innocent light in this story either. Have a look at verse 2. But she was unfaithful to him. She left him and went back to her parents' home in Bethlehem, Judah. Now, what we learn about this Levite is he was probably a very nasty piece of work to live with. So we're slow to judge this woman on abandoning this guy and going back to her parents' house. But the word unfaithful there is a very strong word in the original Hebrew. The King James Version, if you want to go home and look it up, translates that word unfaithful as, get this, she played the whore against him. All right, that's Old English, she played the whore against him. So she didn't just run away here, she first slept around, and that's a sin, plain and simple. But she goes back to her parents' house. Now, after 4 months of being without his sex slave, this Levite devises a plan to get her back. So he travels to Bethlehem, and the concubine and her father welcome him into their house. In fact, so welcoming is the girl's father that the Levite has trouble leaving. Verses 5 to 9 are meant to be comical, as this father-in-law just keeps going, no, stay another night, stay another night, stay another night. Now, the text isn't clear as to why he's so eager to have this Levite stay another night. But if you remember from last week, We learnt that last week the people of Israel saw Levites as good luck charms. They said, oh, now we've got a Levite, God will bless us. This is what this guy's probably doing as well. I've got a Levite here, I need to keep him here for more blessing. Well, the Levite, after a couple of nights, says enough is enough, and he sets out with his party in verse 10, and they go on their way, and as the sun begins to set, they pass Jerusalem, the city of the Jebusites. And his servant says, why don't we stay here? They go, no, we're not staying in a foreign city, right? So Jerusalem was inhabited by the Canaanites at this time. Let's go find an Israelite city. The enormous irony, though, as we find out, is that the Israelite city they find is Israel's equivalent of Sodom and Gomorrah. The party is taken into an elderly man's house from Ephraim, we read, and in verse 22, have a look at verse 22. While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, bring out the man who came to your house so that we can have sex with him. Now, those familiar with the Bible will think this sounds familiar. This is exactly what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities that God determined were so wicked that he would rain down burning sulfur from heaven to destroy them. The only difference with this passage is that these are not rank pagans here. These are the men of Israel acting in this way. Well, the host very bravely goes out to try to persuade these men to not do this outrageous thing, or literally this disgraceful thing. Yet this old man's nobility lasts all of one verse. I saw some people shaking their heads when they read verse 22. Have a look. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I'll bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But as for this man, don't do such an outrageous thing. So even though God created man and woman in his image, equal in God's eyes, this society seems to think that women are of less value than men. We protect men, we'll let women get, well, attacked. And the Levites know better. Have a look at verse 25. But the men would not listen to him, so the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them. And they raped her and abused her throughout the night. And at dawn they basically discarded her. As one commentator put it, if ever a human being endured a night of utter horror, it was this woman. What makes this situation even more horrifying, though, is that she was thrust into this very situation by the person who should have protected her. You see, using women as a shield is the exact opposite of what God wants from men. Hebrews 5:25 says this, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Women are not to be shields for men. Men are to do everything they can to love and protect their women, even with their very lives if necessary. Now, look, Australian society knows that the abuse of women is wrong. Right? Domestic abuse in all its forms, whether it be physical, sexual, emotional, financial, it is 100% shameful and wrong. We know that. What Australians don't realise, and Christians are included in that, is that there are many other ways for husbands to fail in their Ephesians 5:25 mandate. You see, giving up your life, as it says in Ephesians 5:25, doesn't just mean being prepared to die. It means that, but it also means giving up everything else as well. Friends, I think the biggest complaint I hear from Sydney wives is that their husbands don't spend enough time with them because they're too busy at work. Now, what that means is that their husbands are giving up their life for the wrong thing, for work. Now, whether men actually think this or not, what that behavior is saying is that men and men's careers are more important than women, than their wives. Right? The way the men of Israel showed that women were of less value was by using them as shields for protection, for physical protection. The way men in Sydney show that women are of less value than men is by putting them second to their careers, by giving their wives their leftovers. Men, please ask yourself, who would you rather be like? This Levite or Jesus? Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Well, friends, the horror does not stop at verse 25. Look at verse 27. When her master got up in the morning after a lovely night's sleep and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine fallen in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. Then the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. When he reached home, get this, he took a knife and cut up his concubine limb by limb into 12 parts, then sent them into all the areas of Israel. So this Levite strips his poor concubine of her last shred of personhood. Instead of burying her, he uses her body once again to get what he wants. It's not sex this time, it's revenge. Now, it's not revenge for the loss of his loved one, it's revenge for loss of property. That's all she was to him. Well, Israel sees this shocking thing and comes together in Mizpah to find out how this shocking thing has happened in Israel. We pick up the story in chapter 20. They say to the Levite, "What's going on? How did this happen?" The Levite then gives them a very sanitized account of events, conveniently leaving out his own cowardice and callousness. And after hearing most of the story, understand this, they heard most of the story, Israel, all the men of Israel then decide to rise up, go up against Gibeah, verse 9, by lots. Now what's striking here is that they don't ask God whether they should go up or not. They just ask God what order they should go up. That's the only question they ask. Have a look at verse 18. The Israelites went up to Bethel to inquire of God. They said, "Who of us is to go up first to fight against the Benjaminites?" And the Lord replied, "Judah shall go first." So the Israelites, all right, God's given us a command. Let's obey that command. They go up against the Benjaminites, and the Benjaminites cut down 22,000 Israelites. And so they go to God again and say, "What's going on? Should we go up again?" God says, "Go." So they follow God's command and they lose another 18,000 soldiers. What is going on here? What's going on? So the Israelites, they're actually trying to obey God's commands here, but they keep getting slaughtered. Why? Well, what we can surmise from these defeats is that God is not pleased with Israel's actions here. He's not pleased with what Israel's up to. See, what Israel is trying to do is to bring about justice for rape and murder of this woman. Okay? Now, justice would be to execute the perpetrators or those who are trying to protect them. So the Benjaminites say, "No, we're not going to hand them over to you. We're going to protect them. If you want them, you've got to come through us." So that also is injustice. Justice would be to execute the people, the soldiers of the army, all right? But have a look at what Israel does. Verse 48. We're over the page now. So Israel has just, we pick up the story, Israel has just fought the Benjaminites and wiped them out. But then, verse 48, "Then the men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found. All the towns they came across, they set on fire." The reason God is not happy with Israel is because he knows they are not exacting justice here. They're committing genocide. And genocide is not justice. It's vengeance. You see, vengeance stems from allowing one's bitterness and hatred and rage to fester and fester and fester until it boils over. Now, when that happens, when vengeance happens on a national scale, you get things like genocide. But vengeance on a personal level is just as vindictive. So how do we protect ourselves against this? How do we stop ourselves from going down this path, the path of vengeance? Well, plain and simply, we look to Jesus. Have you ever wondered why Jesus' very first appointment on Easter Sunday, right, he's just been resurrected, he's just been vindicated, why wasn't his very first appointment to go and smite those who had killed him? To put to death the Romans and the Jewish leadership. Why didn't he do that? They deserved it. That's justice. Because Jesus practiced forgiveness. Now, the thing about forgiveness is forgiveness does not obstruct justice. It just ensures that justice doesn't turn into vengeance. See, the reason you remember South Africa back in 94, the whole world was saying, we're going to see some genocide here. The only reason we did not see genocide in South Africa in 94 is because when Nelson Mandela became president, he practiced forgiveness. He called for forgiveness. And his people followed him. Forgiveness is the antidote to vengeance. Now, friends, offering forgiveness is not easy. It is super hard. So how do we do it? How do we get the strength, the motivation, the fuel to forgive? Well, again, we look to Jesus. We have all the motivation we need in him. Let me explain. I want you to close your eyes for a moment and picture, like, let's just imagine someone has done something really bad to you. And I want you to picture that sin and imagine it as a big piece of rubbish. Right? You've got a giant piece of rubbish sitting in front of you. But then you look to the right. Right? And to the right of that single bit of rubbish is an enormous pile of rubbish. And this pile of rubbish represents every single sin you've ever committed. And let's be honest, that pile of rubbish, that towers over this thing, that single piece of rubbish on your left. But now imagine Jesus coming and taking that enormous pile of rubbish away at the cost of his own life. Friends, Jesus has forgiven us for countless sins. Countless. How can we accept immeasurable forgiveness with an enormous towering pile of rubbish and then look over at that single piece of rubbish and say, you know what, I'm not going to even bother trying? How can we do that? We can't, can we? You cannot accept God's forgiveness and then turn around in the same breath, reject someone else. If you want strength and motivation and fuel to forgive, we look to Jesus in the immeasurable forgiveness he has given us, and it makes it easy to forgive others. So once we've got the strength and the fuel to forgive, how do we do it? What is the mechanism for forgiveness, the mechanics of forgiveness? Well, look, the beauty of forgiveness is that you can offer forgiveness before you actually feel it. The feelings follow the actions. You see, forgiveness is making a conscious decision not to hold a person's sin against them. You actually promise that you're not going to bring it up anymore, either with them or with others or even with yourself. Now, we can't control when negative thoughts pop into our mind, all right? But forgiveness is saying, when those things pop into my mind uncontrollably, I'm going to choose not to entertain them. We can control that. In fact, I'm going to reject those thoughts, throw those thoughts out straight away, and replace them with kind thoughts about that person. And after we do that, over weeks and months, those kind thoughts turn into kind feelings. That's how it works. And over time, our actions of forgiveness turn into feelings of forgiveness. So when people wrong us in this life, friends, we need to ask ourselves, who do we want to be like? Do we want to be like Israel with their vengeance? Or do we want to be like Jesus with his power to forgive? Well, the story continues. Sorry, I should have mentioned this at the beginning. This is a crazy story. And the craziness is not finished yet. If I don't cover everything, we're going to have a question time at the end. We'll have a question time. You can ask anything you want. But anyway, we've just followed up where we've just seen genocide of the people of Israel, Benjamin. The Israelites then say, oh, wait a minute, now we've got a problem. The tribe of Benjamin is on the verge of extinction. We've only got 600 of them left, men, and we've got no women because we just wiped all the women out. What are we going to do? And on top of that, in chapter 21, verse 1, we see that the men of Israel have made this stupidly rash oath that none of them will give their own daughters to the Benjaminites in marriage. So what do we do? How will the tribe of Benjamin survive? Well, a convenient solution presents itself in verse 5. Now, we didn't read verse 5, but in verse 5, the Israelites say, well, we've all made this rash decision. What are we going to do? Hey, wait a minute. Let's check if anyone else wasn't here. And they find that there was a town that didn't come to the meeting for this holy war and didn't fight with Israel. It was Jabesh Gilead. And so the Israelites said, well, what are we going to do? Is we're going to go punish that town for not turning up. And so they send the army and they wipe out the entire town except for the virgins. Because we've got a use for that 400 virgins. And they take those 400 virgins and they say to the men of Benjamin, here, we've found some wives for you. And these poor teenage girls who have just seen their whole town get massacred, they get forced into marriage. But there's still a problem. We're still 200 short. So we've got another solution. There's a festival that happens every year in Shiloh where all the young girls come out and they dance before the Lord. Here's the idea. So they grab the other 200 single Benjaminites and said, this is what you're going to do. You're going to sneak into this festival, and when the young girls come out to dance before the Lord, pick the one you like and go grab her and kidnap her, and she can be your wife. That's their solution. And so what started out as the nation of Israel coming together for justice over the rape and murder of one woman, look how it's ended up. It has ended up with two counts of mass murder, Benjaminites and Jabesh Gilead, and two counts of mass rape. See, forced marriage equals forced sex, doesn't it? Now, here's the question. How on earth did the men of Israel get it so wrong? How can God's people go so wild? The answer comes from the phrase that sandwiches this whole section. The phrase that was read at chapter 19, verse 1, is repeated in the very last verse. Have a look at chapter 21, verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. The reason Israel got it so wrong was because they took their eyes off God. You see, the phrase Israel had no king basically means Israel had no leader, no judge to keep them on the straight and narrow, to keep them following God. And so the Israelites said, well, let's just figure out for ourselves what is the right thing to do. And there's the solution to their conundrum. Friends, when human institutions ignore God, things go wrong. And do you know who gets hurt the most? Women and children. That's who gets hurt the most when we turn away from God, women and children. I'll give you one example. Our relaxed pornography laws. Okay, back in the 1950s, pornography was illegal. Couldn't get it. But this whole sexual revolution, oh, well, sexual immorality, it's not hurting anyone. Let's have a little bit more sexual immorality. Australian society or Western society, Western governments decided to relax their laws a bit. And so pornography is now everywhere. Do you know who is getting hurt the most by pornography? It's women and children. I'll give you two examples. Our young women are being told by pornography that they need to look like porn stars and act like porn stars if guys are going to like them. And what about our kids? You know, when young boys first view pornography at age 11, and when they first view pornography at age 11, they are taught that that's what real women look like and that's what real sex looks like. Pornography. Now, that's just an example. I actually don't want to focus on human institutions here. We could look at governments all over the world. What I want to focus on is the church. Because this is not some pagan state we're looking at here. This is the people of God. If Judges 19 to 21 is to be held up as a mirror to anyone today, it should be the church, as the new covenant people of God. And I want to suggest that the church is in danger of heading down this path. Now you might say, well, wait a minute, Brendan, come on. We're not ignoring God. Well, neither was Israel. They consulted God on things they wanted to consult God on. Israel's problem was that they had been distracted from God by their surrounding culture. Right, we'll look a bit more into this, but I want to say that so have we as the church. Let me ask you this. What are you passionate about? What are your deep passions? What do you love in life? What do you look forward to each week? Because what we're passionate about is where we set our eyes on. Okay, so if you are passionate about performing at work, if that's what's important to you, then that's where your eyes are going to be set each week. If you are passionate about seeing your kids thrive and have all the opportunities available to them, that's where your eyes are going to be set. If you are passionate about your hobbies, whether it be watching TV or movies or sport or whatever it is, that's what you're going to focus on. That's what you're going to look forward to. And when you're focusing on your work or your kids or your hobbies, you take your eyes off God. You see, the problem with Israel is that God had become an afterthought. Sure, we've made our decision, but let's check with God what order we should go in. Right? God was an afterthought. They were so preoccupied with what the surrounding culture had told them that they stopped looking like Israel and started looking like the pagan culture around. Friends, it's the same with the church. We are so preoccupied by what society says we should be passionate about that we no longer look like God's people. We look like Australian society. We're passionate about what Australian society is passionate about. Now, we may not look like Israel here, but let me tell you, Christians from around the world look at the West, the church in the West, and they look down on us in judgment as well. They judge our spending, they judge our viewing, they judge our fashion, they judge our mortgages, they judge our alcohol, they judge our kids. We look just like Aussie culture. So how do we fix it? And that's what we want, isn't it? We don't want to go down this path. Well, again, we fix it by looking at Jesus. What was Jesus passionate about? He was passionate about his Father. Everything he did was for God. What we need as Christians is to make God our number one passion in life. All right? Rather than be passionate about our work and succeeding in our work, we need to be passionate about serving God in ministry. Rather than be passionate about getting to work on time each day, we need to be passionate about church and getting to church. Rather than be passionate about TV or footy, let's be passionate about how our Christian brothers and sisters are doing. Rather than be passionate about our careers, let's be passionate about growing God's kingdom. Rather than be passionate about me and my reputation, let's be passionate about God. And it's only then that we will fix our eyes on God and do everything for Him. Friends, the reason Israel strayed so far from God's path was because they became passionate about the world's path. The way we can avoid this same fate is to become a people who are deeply, deeply passionate about what really matters in life. And it's not career. And it's not our kids' education. And it's not our hobbies. It's God. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these other things will be given to you as well. Friends, let's be passionate about God. Questions or comments? It's a horrifying passage, but a wonderful message. God can bring wonderful things out of the worst. Looks like we're all speechless. Dave, is it a token? You don't have to give me a token one. Okay, it's a real one. Look, they should have consulted God. They should have asked God. What they started out, like, I think the reason God judged them was because he saw their hearts and he saw what was going on. And he saw what was going to happen. And he knew they weren't there for justice, they were there for vengeance. What they should have done was say, all right, God, look, there's a bad thing that's happened. We need to purge Israel of this evil. It's a right thing to do. The law said murder, rape, you get stoned to death. All right. The Benjaminites had done the wrong thing. They closed ranks around these wicked men and decided, nah. Our tribe is more important than justice. That was wrong. But they should have consulted God earlier rather than later. That's what I think they should have done. And God would have told them, you know, what to do. And I think they would have, well, the problem with Israel throughout Judges is they're not following God. They are pagans that are just being tugged every so often back towards God. God was unhappy, I think, with the whole of, you know, Israel throughout the whole of the Judges period. So whether God was just judging the Israelites at that particular moment in history or for the last, you know, couple of hundred years, I'm not sure, but God wasn't happy. They should have consulted God, though. Yeah. Poida. Yeah. Yep. Their concern was, so they made the oath in the original, I would think, the original meeting they had. They said, what are we going to do? We're going to go up against the Benjaminites. And they're really wicked. They've done the wrong thing. So that's when they made the oath. We're not going to give any of them our daughters. They are so wicked and so evil. All right? Now, it was a stupid and rash oath. But because of the situation that Israel is in at the time, they thought, well, we have to keep these oaths. Just like you remember Jephthah, he made an oath to sacrifice a daughter. He shouldn't have done that. That was a stupid thing to do. Yes. Yeah. But then, after their genocide, they go, oops, we've wiped out all their women. And then they go and complain to God as though it's God's fault. Right? But then they go, well, we've got to keep this oath, so let's try and find another solution. And it turns out there was a town that hadn't made the oath. And so they said, well, they'll be fine. And then they go and kidnap these other women, and by kidnapping, they're again not breaking their oath because they didn't give their daughters in marriage. Their daughters were kidnapped in marriage. So it's just, look, it's just all-round horrific treatment of women. First they wipe them out, then they send them off to be raped by their new husbands, who were the original perpetrators of this horrible act anyway. But I think, yeah, I think they were just desperately thinking they were trying to do the right thing, they just were not consulting God in how to do the right thing. And they came up with their own idea of how to do the right thing. Like, yeah, sure, pornography, whatever. Mark. Okay, so Mark's question is to do with the king. So it's an interesting phrase Israel had no king. It is looking forward to the kingship. In particular, we hope the Davidic kingship, but the Davidic kingship as it goes on shows us that the Davidic kingship is no good either. We need a better king. And that better king, of course, is Jesus. But Mark's question is God happy when Israel's kings are doing the right thing? The thing is, when Israel's king is doing the right thing, he's leading the people to do the right thing as well. And so there's a close connection between leadership in the Bible and in life, between leadership and the people that they're leading. So if the king is doing the right thing, generally the leader, the people fall in line. When the king is doing the wrong thing, the people, I don't know if they necessarily fall in line straight away, but they have more and more liberty to do what is right in their own eyes. And so God is not happy when his people, whoever it is, are not following him. What he wants, when he got in King David, was a man after his own heart, a man that was passionate for God. And you read the Psalms of David, and he just loved God. That's what he was passionate about. And the people fell in line. They said, look at this guy. He loves God. Let's do that as well. So I think it's not just the king or the leader. I think it's when the people, like generally, are caught up with the leader in what the leader is doing. Sadly, when they are without a leader, there's no one to keep them in line, and so they have more liberty again and start doing what is right in their own eyes. Yes? Are you asking the mechanics of how he answers them? Like, is it a booming voice or? Yeah. Yes, okay, good question. So what is the actual mechanics through which God speaks to his people in the Old Testament? And there are various forms. Okay, so prophets is one of them. And just because the prophet is not mentioned doesn't mean there's not one available or one there. But I don't think there was a prophet in this story, but in other stories there might have been. He also spoke to them through visions and dreams, particular people and the leaders and the priests, but there was also another way, which is called the, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Urim and Thurim. They were basically like a set of dice that the high priest used. And the high priest would throw this dice and say, right, if it rolls this, then we get this answer. If it rolls that, then we get that answer. And we don't know exactly how it worked, but they would, you know, cast. It was almost casting a lot. And so what they did was they went to God and said, okay, who shall go first? We'll cast lots, and the lot that came up was Judah. So I think that's how it happened in those days. In these days, though, we don't need prophets or casting of lots. The last time we hear of casting of lots in the Bible is in Acts chapter 2. It was Acts chapter 1, sorry, when they are looking for someone to replace Judas. After that, they had the prophets and the apostles, and we now today have what they wrote down. So this is how God speaks to us today. In terms of, you know, guidance as in, do I become a teacher or an engineer? All we can do is make a decision in the most godly way we can. So if I become a teacher, then I get to teach people and teach kids and grow our next generation. But if I become an engineer, I get to make more money. All right? Which decision do you make? You make the godly one. God doesn't care about money. He cares about raising up our next generation. So that's the kind of decision we need to make. We need to base our decisions on what God teaches us. Yeah. Maybe one last question. Yes, Dave. Yeah. 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 So Dave's asked one of the big questions of our culture, the problem of suffering. And if we look at, you know, even in the Bible, I mean, look, it happens today. You know, why is God allowing Ukraine and Middle East, Palestine and Syria and Iraq and you name it? Why is God allowing this to happen? The big answer to that is, just because we don't see a reason for it, doesn't mean there isn't a reason. One of the answers that was given, I think it's oxygen issue, was, you know, if you think you can do a better job than God, then you can when you get your own universe to run. Basically, when we think God's got it wrong, we're sitting in judgment over God. We have no idea what's going on. No idea. What we do know, though, is that God is in complete control and that God is good. And that he can bring good things out of evil. He is not causing, that's another thing we know, he's not causing this to happen, he is grieved by it. And we see it when God judges Israel by what Israel is doing at the moment. So is God from time to time will judge people for their wickedness, and God is very grieved by the sin that goes on in the world. That's the big difference between Christianity and every other religion. Every other religion says, you know, whatever happens, happens, or God is a vindictive God. Christianity says God is a loving God, and he is deeply, deeply grieved by sin in this world, and he has a plan for one day wiping that out completely, and we look forward to that. So that's a bit of a long-winded answer. It's probably not the whole story, but that is the basics of what I would say. We don't know what's going on. There might be a good reason, but God is in control. He hates the wickedness that is going on in the world, and he is working to one day eradicate it. Denise. Yeah. So again, another big question that's asked by people, where, you know, the God of the Old Testament was a spiteful God and the God of the New Testament is a God of love. When you read both Testaments, you find that that's utter rubbish. God is completely loving and passionate in the Old Testament. And you know who talks about hell and judgment the most in the Bible? It's Jesus. And he says, repent or you will spend eternity in hell and suffering. That's Jesus. So they're both the exact same God. They are a God who hates sin, who will one day bring sin to judgment, but who loves those who turn to him and want to save them, and he went to the extent of giving his own son's life for it. We have an awesome God, a God who doesn't say to you, I want you to sacrifice to me. He says to you, look what I've sacrificed to you. Let me tell you, that is the God I want to serve. That's the God I want to serve, a God who will sacrifice for me. That's why I want to be so passionate about God. I mean, he deserves it. He is the only thing really worth being passionate about. Paying your mortgage off, getting that promotion, seeing your kids excel in sport, they're down here. God is the only thing worth being passionate about, and that's what we need to be passionate about. More questions, please see me afterwards. Thanks, Dave. We're going to sing. And it's a new song, and Ian's going to introduce it.